This is the Sports Chronicle Podcast.
Ken Doherty, Irish snooker legend, sporting legend. Thanks very much for joining us here on the Sports Chronicle. I suppose we'll just jump straight into it. You had an interest in snooker from a very, very early age. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I used to watch snooker on the old BBC, like the Pop Black days. And of course, Pop Black only came on BBC Two, I think it was, once a week. I started watching it with my dad, you know, and I was only about like 8 at the time, so this was going back to like 1977, and that's when I saw Alex Higgins play, and I was allowed to stay up to watch it. My father was a big Ray Reardon fan, he let me watch, and I saw Alex Higgins play Ray Reardon there in Pop Black, and I was just mesmerised. I knew there was a couple of snooker clubs in Renle. Already, and my brother used to play, my two brothers used to play a little bit. But when I saw him there, I thought, wow, he just, I was captivated by it. And he was so fast, and he was Irish, you know, and he had a bit of sort of charisma about him. And that's when I fell in love with snooker. And I got a snooker table from Santa that year, and it was at the bottom of my bunk bed. It was only about this size. And we used to put it on our kitchen table, you know, when the plates were cleared, and we'd play, have endless hours of fun with it and bring my friends in, or play with my brothers, or, you know, it was just great fun, and I fell in love with the game from then.
And who would have won most of those games?
Well, initially I wasn't very good at all, so my big brothers were sort of better than me, but once I got to the hang of it, and then of course, I used to plead with my eldest brother Seamus to bring me around to Jason's, which just opened, I think, in 1976 in Ranelagh. And that was the first snooker club they had. It wasn't the first snooker club, it was the second. They had another one with three tables, but Jason's had a jukebox, had the Space Invader machines, had like an Evel Knievel pinball machine, and had a pool table and a snooker table. And it was sort of like the hub of the area. But I wasn't allowed in at that stage. I could only go in on a Sunday afternoon for about an hour with my biggest brother. And so I used to plead with him every Sunday, driving mad to bring me in. And then I used to have to stand on these old biscuit tins, you know, to reach the table. But once I got my foot in the door, that was it. There was no going back.
And what was it, I suppose, a bit daunting to see the size of a snooker table at that age?
Yeah, it was, you know, because when you see it on TV, it doesn't look that big. But then, of course, when you know, you come in and you try and play on it, for an 8-year-old, it is quite daunting. But the biscuit tin came in handy. I'd kick it around the table, stand on it, play a shot. And of course, the pool table wasn't too bad. You sort of started off on that. But we used to have some endless hours. You know, when I was old enough then, I'd like get off the bus from school, pass by, they wouldn't even go into the house, pass in straight into Jason's, the school bag, go under the table. And you know, I used to have to like empty ashtrays, clear out bins, sweep the floor just to get a free game of like pool or snooker, or a few free games on the old Space Invaders or the Asteroid machine at the time as well. And yeah, it was endless hours of fun spent in Jason's.
And would any of your opponents might have seen to it that the biscuit tin went missing?
Yeah. I mean, that's what happened a few times. They thought, this cocky little so-and-so, you know, we'll sort him out. So when I used to be some of the older guys in there, yeah, the biscuit tin went missing a few times. They used to hide the biscuit tin on me. So I was at a disadvantage straight away. But yeah, they were some good times. I mean, they never even used to switch on the light because the snooker table was right beside the window. So Ambrose Collins, who I have a picture with over there, he used to let me play on it once I did a few chores around the snooker club. And he'd say, like, give me the few balls. And he wouldn't put the light on because that would clock up on the old digital computer. So he'd say, just hit a few balls there, you know, and the sunlight would be the light, basically, you know. So that's how I really started.
You picked up your snooker cue, mm. I suppose, an unusual situation.
Well, they always say he plays with the 2-pound like warped stolen cue from Jason, but it wasn't really stolen. Of course, going in there every day, I knew all the snooker cues or the pool cues, as it were, because I used to try and get the best one I didn't have one of my own. I think this was about when I was about 10 or 11. There was a queue left on the pill rack, a bit like the pill rack over here. I picked it up and I knew it wasn't a house queue because the house queues all had Jason's written on them. So I started playing and I thought, well, somebody must have left it behind and it was put back up on the queue rack, you know. So I started playing with it for the day. I loved it. It was a lovely, like, ash queue and it felt really nice. It was a nice weight and it just, like, fitted me perfect. Like, you know, I really enjoyed playing with it. At the end of the day, I asked the manager, I said, look, somebody's left this behind. If they don't come back, you know, can I keep it, you know, like, for saying, like, you know, for his keeps. He said, well, give us a fiver for it, you know, and you can have it. Of course, I didn't have a fiver, you know. And money was pretty tight at home, but I ran around to my mother. I said, look, I'll do some summer jobs. I'll give you the money back. I'll try and make it up to you. I said, I need this queue, you know. Anyway, she gave me an old £5 note. And there's a post office next to Jason's at the time. I went into the post office and I changed it into five old pound notes, you know, at the time. I put £3 in this pocket and I put £2 in this pocket and I went back in town and I said, look, I said, mother doesn't have much money. I put my hand in the pocket and I showed him the £2. I said, this is all she could afford, you know. So he looked at the queue, he looked at the £2. He says, give me the bleeding £2 then, you know. So he took the £2 and I have the queue ever since. And thankfully, nobody ever came back to claim the queue. And that's a queue I still have today. Here it is. And it's a little bit warped in the middle, like, you know. But I've had it since 1980, 81, and everything I've won, you know, from the time I was a junior right up to the World Championship trophy you see in the background there is all with the old £2 queue. So it wasn't a bad investment. But I hope nobody ever comes back to try and look for it, but it's gone now anyway, you know. But yeah, this is I still have it here now.
Unreal. Mm. And was there kind of any particular moment or series of events where you were like, do you know what, I could make a go of this?
You know, something like I played, like I won the Irish under 16 championship when I was about 13 and I just like loved it, you know. I just like loved the competition, loved playing all the better players. I used to jump on the bus from Renlet into town, I'd get on the 11, I'd stop off in the Cosmo or the Home of Billiards or the Piro on Bachelor's Walk, which is now the Arlington. Like there were three snooker clubs within like 300 yards of each other there, right on the quays. And they were, I used to love going in playing the older players and I'd go in with like a fiver in my pocket maybe, you know, when I was about 13, 14. And I'd try and like play guys for best of three for five, I'd try and spin it up, you know, and if I won it, I'd try and spin it up again and then, but I'd start off in the club that would have the least best players and then I'd move on to the second, and because as you sort of graded up, they played for a bit more money, you know, so you try and spin, you know. And I did that like right up until the time I was about, until I left school, you know. But I gained so much great experience and that's why probably, you know, I've been given the sort of the title of Crafty Ken, like, you know what I mean, because I played a lot in those situations as a young kid, playing against the older generation who played that type of game. And you had to play that type of game because you were playing for like money that, you know, if you didn't have, you might have had just about enough for the bus fare, or sometimes you didn't have enough for the bus fare home. And as many a times I had to walk back from O'Connell Street with nothing in my pocket but just the £2 queue with me. But it gave me good grounding, you know, when I moved to England. I thought, like, when I left school, I thought, okay, we'll go to England, give it a go, and if it doesn't work out, I can come back. I finished my leaving cert, I come back and, you know, just play from here and get a job or something like that. So I didn't really think I was ever going to make it until I sort of went away and see how good I was, because I was might have been a big fish in a small pool here, but when I went to England, there was another 100 players just like me or even better than me over there, you know, so I had to go over and see how good I was against those. And it was only after sort of a couple of years and when I won the World Amateur Championship in 89, won the World Junior Championship in 89 as well, that I really thought, well then, yeah, maybe I can give this a go and I can maybe turn professional and see where it takes me.
You said that you started watching snooker at an early age with your father, and I know he passed away when you were very young. But was he a big kind of motivator for you to get into the sport?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I look when I look back on it, I mean, he loved snooker. He was the one who got me into snooker. And yeah, I mean, my father died when I was 13. I was in Jason's at the time. He took a heart attack on Rendlor Road up in Sanford on the way back from my sister's school play. And I was told, the guy came into Jason's to tell me when I was playing there. And he died a couple of days later in Vincent's Hospital just down the road. So I think, like, in the back, at the time, you didn't sort of think about it, you know, but he was a big loss. But, I sort of miss him as I sort of grew older and I was playing. I missed him because I know he would have loved to have been around me, you know, and watching me. Just my son plays tennis and I love going to watch him play. And I think, you know, of all the regrets of losing him so young, you know, at 13 years of age was quite hard. But I think, yeah, he would have been a big motivation. And of course, my mum as well, even though they didn't want me to play snooker, you know, they said, you know, do your homework, you know, go to school and try and get a decent, proper job, you know what I mean? So they weren't really sort of pushing me, but they always supported me, you know, and I think my dad would have been, yeah, he would have loved to come around to the tournaments and meet the players. He would have met Ray Reardon, you know, he would have met Alex Higgins, you know, he would have met Jimmy, we would have loved him, you know? So that's just the way life goes sometimes.
Yeah, and I suppose you said that Jason's was something of a community hub. Was it a big help to have that kind of support system there for you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it was a difficult time because there were four kids, you know, that my mother had to rear on her own. But I got a lot of support, and it was like only from, you know, the people who own Jason's. They thought, okay, let's give them free practice, and we'll start them off with like an hour a day or something like that. And then they started sponsoring me into tournaments because they knew that money was pretty tight at home and my mother couldn't afford to send me away to tournaments and stuff like that. So the support from them and the family, the Cosgrave family, certainly helped, you know. And I don't think I would have been, you know, here today or would have done anything in the game without that help and that support. I think it was crucial at the time, yeah. So it's funny the way things work out, I suppose.
You had a lot of support from your principal in Christian Brothers as well, did you?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I mean, again, like, you know, I remember the teacher saying to me one day, you know, he did a roll call and he looked back on the days missed from the whole class from the previous year. And he said, Doherty, I see you missed 25 days from school last year, you know. And you were obviously playing snooker somewhere, you know. I said, I hope I'll be seeing a bit more of you this year, you know. And I said, oh, well, it's funny you should say that, sir. I'm off to New Zealand to play in the World Amateur Championships. I'll be gone for 3 weeks, you know. Give up that bloody game, Doherty. There's no future in that snooker at all. Think of getting a real job, you know, and get your education, you know. Funny enough, there are two snooker tables in my old school now, you know, that I've given them, you know, because the primary is gone and they had a few free classes, so people contacted me with snooker tables in the house, say, do you have any place for these? I didn't have a place, but I rang the school. I said, do you want these snooker tables? So they've tucked them in. So there's now snooker tables and pool tables there. And the teacher, who's since retired, but the principal was very, very, delighted to get them because he used to have the students knocking on the door at like 8:30 in the morning. They wanted to come in and have a game of snooker before they go up to the classes. Normally the teacher would be knocking on their door outside trying to get them out of bed to come into school. So it had a great effect. So it was quite ironic, really, you know.
It must fill you with pride to see that kind of trickle-down effect that your old school and the chance to help them out.
Yeah,
with
yeah. I mean, my principal was fantastic, a Christian brother called Paul Hendry. And, you know, they were very supportive. They knew that I was mad keen on it, you know. And they loved sport down there, but snooker wasn't on the top of their list. It was obviously GAA, being Christian Brothers, Forest and then football or basketball. But they were very supportive, you know. They didn't sort of curtail me going away. Once, like, you'd always insist on bringing your books away and do some sort of, you know, catching up if you could. But yeah, they were very, very good to me, and you know, I really appreciate that. And that's why, you know, I've always like gone back to the school and giving out the trophies. I've seen the old teachers, And it was nice to, they wanted to have a, build a computer room. It's an inner city school, doesn't have much money. So we had a little charity night here a couple of weeks ago and we raised quite a lot of money. So it looks like we're going to give them about maybe 15,000 to build our little computer room. So that would be quite nice, you know, and nice to do something, you know, because they helped me a lot, like in the early days. So it's nice to be able to sort of give something back to them, you know, and yeah, just show your appreciation, I suppose, you know.
Absolutely, yeah, no, that's brilliant to be able to give back to like that. You were saying that you probably, like, would you have gotten any kind of stick for playing snooker seriously, I suppose, rather than the GA or the rugby? Or
yeah, I mean, you know, they didn't really, even though they supported, they always, the GAA was number one. I mean, you used to have to sell the GAA lions and the cards, you know, to raise money. And they had a football team, which I played on, but when I got a belt of a hurley stick and nearly lost my eye when I was about 13 or 14, I thought that was it for me. You know, I wasn't playing hurling anymore. I could come into Jason's, I'd be in a nice cosy room, and I'd be able to play. I was one of the richest kids in the class, like from playing with the money for fivers or tenors, you know, and I could always come in with like a quarter of cola cubes or a quarter of bonbons. I'd always have money on a Monday morning. Like from playing snooker on the weekends, you know, so I couldn't get that playing GAA or hurling, so I thought I was down up, the finances were a lot better in the snooker world.
And once you finished your leaving cert, you went over to England then, what was that like? Was that a daunting experience?
It was, yeah, it was quite daunting. There was a couple of us and we went over, I had £500 in my pocket and that was it, that's all the money I had saved up, and I thought that was going to last me forever. And the reality soon kicked in when I got over there. But I had free digs and I was getting free snooker practice over in Ilford Snooker Centre where Eugene Hughes, who was an Irish professional, and he said, look, come over. He said, we'll get you free practice. You won't have to pay. You just get here every day or whatever and you can play as long as you like, which was fantastic. You know, we were staying in digs in southwest London, which wasn't geographically wasn't great when you had to get to the east side of London. It was 36 stops on the district line, then two buses. So it used to take us about an hour and a half to get there and then an hour and a half back after all the practice. So we did that for a few weeks until we got some digs over in Essex, which made a lot more sense. And that's how it started. And that was back in 1988. And then you were just playing, like, you had no job. You were just playing snooker and you were playing in sort of pro-ams every weekend to be a pro-am. Like in Manchester or Birmingham or Luton or, you know, Great Yarmouth or all over the country. But in that snooker club, there was about five or six amateurs. So they'd be all going, getting lifts. So they'd be bumming lifts or getting buses or trains or whatever, but mainly get lifts to the pro-ams. And I sort of survived on pro-ams till 1990, like until I won the World Amateur Championship and got a free ticket into the pro game. But yeah, it was quite difficult.
Were there any moments over in London, obviously, like, there's a lot of public transport and lifts, like you said, where, say, a queue might have gone missing?
Well, it wasn't a queue. Well, I had one, I mean, you won't believe the story, but there was one incident. We were living in a bed and breakfast, paying like 50 quid a week to an Irish couple, husband from the north, wife from the south. And it was bed and breakfast, and sometimes she might get an evening meal, but she washed her clothes and everything. It was perfect, like 50 quid, it was great, right beside the snooker club. My friend who was sharing the twin room with, he came home late one night, and the husband and wife are in the other bedroom. I'm in the bedroom, I'm fast asleep, I'm only about 18, dreaming about winning the world championship. And he came in late one night, and it came in about 1 o'clock. He got a job, like, he was doing a bit of work. And anyway, he's going up the stairs and the kitchen light is on and he smells something from the kitchen. So he's gone in, he's opened the door of the kitchen and there's three rings of gas on full blast and the oven is on full blast and there's one ring only lighting. And the guy upstairs, the husband, he's tried to, like, blow the house up, you know? Now I'm in the bedroom next to him, so he's tried to, you know, kill everybody in the house, basically, and blow it out. He's had enough of life, you know. Little did I know, and I'm sleeping in the bed in the room next to him. And he's in the room with his wife, and only for my mate who came in at that time, and got smelt the gas and switched everything off and opened all the windows. Like, if he had been half an hour or so late, I don't know what would have happened, but certainly the house was going up and I was going with it, and that was it. There was no snooker for Ken Doherty after that. So that was the, I think that was the hairiest moment. But she was great for the breakfasts. But that is about as close as I've come to it, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. Did you stay there much longer?
No. Thankfully, we packed our bags that night. We were gone at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he ran up the stairs. He says, "You won't believe what's after happening downstairs," you know. He says, "Pack your bags." He says, "We're out of here," you know. But yeah, that was how close it came.
That's insane.
It's mental. It's mental.
Just you said there that you were up in bed dreaming about winning the World Championship.
Yeah, yeah.
Seeing that actually come to fruition against Stephen Hendry in 1997,
I used to dream about it all the time, you know, because when I watched Alex win it in 82 and of course Dennis win it in 85, and I thought, you know, I used to go to bed at night dreaming about lifting that trophy the way they did, giving it a big kiss and waving it around to the crowd, and that sort of stayed in my mind, like that was what was driving me, you know. I wanted to do that, to try and emulate what those two great players had done before me. And when I played Stephen Hendry in the final, like, I mean, Stephen Hendry had won it 5 years previous, so he was going for like six in a row, 30 matches unbeaten, which was an incredible feat. Like, so it was like basically playing him on his own table in his own backyard. He'd become so used to it. And I was like a complete underdog, but I sort of, you know, I had that vision of me picking up the trophy, you know. I could see it every time I went to bed at night. I could see it, and it sort of kept me going. And it sort of, I had a sort of a calmness against him, you know, that, like, normally if you're playing Stephen Hendry, you'd be, like, shitting yourself, like, you know what I mean? But I had a calmness, I had a belief, you know. I was smiling, I was happy, you know. I wasn't afraid of him, you know, because I'd beaten him a few times as well, in finals as well. So that sort of gave me a little bit of confidence, but I really could see it. I could visualize it, and people always talk about the power of visualization, and for me that sort of kept me going, and I could see myself lifting the trophy, and because of it I just played out of my skin, you know, completely kept him out of it, and he got very frustrated, you know, from the very first session. He made three centuries in the very first session, eight frames, and he was 5-3 down, and then I won the next session 6-2, so I'm 11-5 up overnight. Then I went 15-7, and then he won the last two. And I was 15, like 9 up, going into the last session, and he won. And that was when I sort of started to feel the pressure. That was the only time I really felt the pressure in that final, because he'd gone from 15-7, won the last two, 15-9. Then he won the first three of the evening session. So, you know, like when you get to the evening session, you can sort of see the winning line, and of course when he's over your shoulder. And he's made so many great comebacks in the past, and I thought, oh, please don't do it now. Like, not against me, not here, not there. And I really started to, you know, cramp up, as it were. But I managed just to win six, go 16-12. He missed one red along the back cushion that you would have fancied him to get. And he could have gone 15-13, and then it could have gone either way. But I won that frame 16-12. And I was like, there was a whole weight lifted off my shoulders. And then I went into the dressing room. We had our mid-session interval, and then I came out and then won the last two. But it was just, it was incredible, you know. And you know, the dreams and came true, like, you know, lifting the trophy, picking it up, you know, friends up. None of the family were there. They couldn't make it. They were too nervous. But all the friends who had come over, up on the balcony, and it was just, it was a fantastic feeling, yeah.
Really? And yeah. Were you in something of a bubble, or were you aware that Ireland had essentially come to a
No, no, I was in a complete bubble. Like, I tried to keep myself away from, when I played my match, get out and get back to the hotel, go for a swim, or go for a walk, or go to the pictures, or do something, but just, like, keep away from the crucible. Didn't want to know what was happening back home, because I knew it was great excitement, but I didn't want to get really sort of too caught up in it. I didn't want to hear too many stuff. Like, it was beyond the phone to my mum, or, you know, saying, like, you know, how he's coping, like, you know, how you cope. No, I'm okay, how are you coping, you know? But I knew there was an exciting build, but I didn't really want to know about it too much, you know. I just wanted to keep, like, in a little bubble and in the zone, basically, because you could get carried away with it, you know, like, you hear stories, like, And I didn't, and I mean, the homecoming, like, I wasn't expecting any of that whatsoever. Like, I mean, that was a complete surprise to me.
And I suppose your mother was happy for you to have gone down.
Yeah, I mean, my mother, she left the house because they had an RTE crew and they had, like, I don't know, about 10 journalists had descended on 3 Renla Avenue. But my mother got out. My mother suffered from high blood pressure, you know? And she used to get nervous as hell. She never, ever saw me play live. She'd only watch it if it was recorded and I won. If I lost, she wouldn't watch it. But she'd tape it. And if I won, she'd watch it. But she got out of the house in the morning time. She never came back. She was away on her bike and she was went into town to the churches. She was finished out in Donnybrook Church, lighting candles. That's where she got married. She got a puncture in the wheel of her bike and had to walk back from Donnybrook. And it was only on the way back through Donnybrook that somebody had stopped her to say, do you know your son has just won the World Championship? Like, you know, so she came home and then that was it. Like, you know, it's incredible, yeah.
Brilliant. And she passed away last year?
Yeah, she passed away last year, yeah. She got pancreatic cancer and she was diagnosed and she was gone within about 4 weeks, you know. So she never smoked or drank in her life, you know. She had a tough life, but she was a great woman, you know. Very strong woman, and she couldn't watch me play, as I said. She came out to Goffs once. I was playing Ronnie O'Sullivan in the final. And she thought, okay, well, he's in the final, it won't be too bad, I'll go out and watch him. But she spent all the time out in the car park with her rosary beads and with the car park attendants, you know. And that was quite nice in a way, but quite sad in a way as well, you know. But yeah, she was a great woman. I miss her dearly now, you know.
And you had a tribute to her when you were on the restaurant at TV3 as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, she was a great cook, you know, that was her job. She used to cook for the students up in Trinity Hall. And of course, like, when I was asked to go on the restaurant, I thought, would I really like to go? And I thought, oh, yeah, I'll give it a go. Because I like cooking, but I'm no good at it, you know. I could burn a salad, like, you know what I mean? I really enjoyed it, and I thought, I'd do something sort of. She was still alive at the time, you know, and I thought I'd do something that, you know, that we sort of were used to sort of eating as we were growing up, like, you know, fish on a Friday with a cold cannon, like, you know, that would be our every, so that was our vol-au-vents. If we were treated, you know, mushroom vol-au-vents was a treat we'd get every now and again. And she used to bake apple tarts, so we had apple tart and ice cream, and that was basically the menu on my mother's side, you know. But unfortunately, she died before it came out. She died in March and it just came out in April, so she never got to see it. But I told her all about it, and she probably would have been critical on how I cooked you know, the cold cannon, but I think she would have enjoyed it, you know.
Was she, I suppose, delighted with all the acclaim that came with?
No, not at all. Didn't like it at all. She was very shy, you know, but she was very proud of that cup. You know, the cup used to sit on our TV in the living room in Renla. And, like, you know, you pass by the window, you'd see the cup on the TV, and she'd shine it every day. She'd come in and she'd lift it up and she'd give it a kiss every morning. And anybody who knocked on the door, oh yeah, come on in, get a picture, there's the cup there, you know, help yourself. Like, the door was always open, but she was very proud, yeah. But she didn't like the attention at all. Hated photographs, hated, like, you know, when TV came to do interviews, she wouldn't have any of it, you know. She was quite shy in that respect, but I think she was quite proud in the end. Like,
absolutely. And it must have been something of a whirlwind for yourself.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, I think the homecoming was quite special. You know, it wasn't, as I said, I wasn't expecting that. You know, like, coming back in the open top bus and all the cars tooting and stopping, like, and people hanging out of office block buildings and running down, you know, stopping on the side of the street, like O'Connell Street, was amazing. And then, of course, getting to Renla. And the whole of Renla out, and there was a big, like, we had a big party in Renla, and there was a bandstand, and we got up and sang songs and everything. It was quite incredible. I wasn't expecting that at all. I was supposed to, when I won it on the bank holiday Monday, I'd booked my flight to come back on the Tuesday. And Tony O'Donoghue from RTE had been over for a couple of days. He said, look, he says, can you wait another day? He said, I think they're trying to plan something for you coming back. So I said, okay, no problem, I'll book him. So we came back on the Wednesday, and of course, it tells people at the airport, and then the two open top buses, one for all the journalists and the camera crews, and then one for all the family. And it was, it was great. It was really special, you know. But my mother, we were all on the top of the bus, and there's pictures around the room on the top of the bus, but she wouldn't get up to the top of the bus. She sat downstairs next to the bus driver, you know, with all other family and friends. Yeah, she wouldn't have it, but everybody else really enjoyed it, you know. And yeah, it was like one of those days that, you know, it'll never happen again, like, you know. And but once was enough, I think, you know.
You had an interesting chat with the superintendent as well.
I did, yeah. That was the funniest story. I mean, I recant that story many a times. But when I got back to, there was a big civic reception in the Mansion House in Dublin, and the Lord Mayor presented me with a beautiful piece of crystal. And the chief superintendent came over to me. He says, Doherty, he said, I want to tell you a story about Monday night, you know. And I said, yeah. I said, it was actually the first time that actually RT had taken the pictures. They bought the pictures from BBC, so the whole country sort of could see the whole the World Championship, just only the final session, you know. And he says, you know, he says, between the hours of 7 and 10, the Central Police Station, Harcourt Street, hadn't got one phone call. Did you know that? I says, no. I says, yeah. He says, no, we normally get a phone call every 5 minutes, you know. He says, and the girls in the switchboard thought there was something wrong with the phones and rang the main switchboard in Telecom Aaron saying, is there something wrong with our phones? We haven't had a phone call here for the last 15, 20 minutes. And the girl on the other end of the line says, are you not watching the snooker? The whole country is, you know. And he says, Doherty, you should be on television more often. He says, you make my job a hell of a lot easier, you know. So it stopped crying for 3 hours in the city of Dublin, but no doubt, like, they made up for lost time afterwards, I'm sure.
Now, winning the final in 97, the flip side then, losing in 2003 to Mark Williams. Tell us about that.
You sort of, you know, it was amazing because I had such a good run in 2003 to get to the final. You know, I had a dramatic very first round against Sean Murphy, 10-9. I played Graham Dott, 13-12. I beat him. I was 10-0 up on John Higgins in the quarterfinals, eventually won 13-8. And then, of course, I checked out my hotel. I was playing Paul Hunter in the semi-final. I was 15-9 down. He had to win two frames. I had to win eight. And I ended up beating him 17-16. It was the greatest match I think I've ever played at the Crucible. Even the final, against Stephen Hendry, that comeback was like quite incredible. And then all of a sudden I was in the final again and losing. I was 10-2 down in the final to Mark Williams, got back to 12-all. And we went toe-to-toe right to 16-all until he won the last two. And sort of broke my heart. Like, it was absolutely devastating because I'd sort of climbed ever so many times during the 17 days. And to win it would have been one of the best of all time, like, in all the history. Like, it's 41 years now at the Crucible. But I think to win that would have been one of the best. And to lose it was one of the worst, it felt like. And anyway, you know, I think that was one that really got away. And it was quite difficult. Because, you know, like, when you are world champion, you know, when I won it in 97, you know, and I talked about all the crowds and the open top buses, I got to the final the following year in 98. And I lost in the final. I came back and I had to get a taxi home, you know. So there's a big difference. There was nobody at the airport. You just go on your own. So losing it in 2003, yeah, it's such a great time as world champion. And not having the cup and not being world champion, get your name on the cup for the second time. Yeah, that was quite difficult, you know. But
it must have been a tough few days after
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a tough few days. It was a tough few months, you know. And it took me a long time to get over it, I know that, you know. And even now you look back on it and you think, that got away, you know. You still sort of, it still irks me, you know.
Yeah. And I suppose you look at the way the game has kind of moved on since that kind of era.
Yeah.
Kind of Barry Hearn's had a big kind of effect.
Yeah. Since Barry Hearn has taken over, I think it's about 8 years now. I mean, he's done an incredible job. I mean, we were down to like 6 ranking tournaments. One every like 4 weeks basically, and like he's completely changed now. Like we have like 20 tournaments to play in a year. We've 8 tournaments in China alone. The prize money has gone from like 3.5 million up to I think it's going to be 15 million this year, you know. So it's a great time to be a snooker professional, you know. And in a way, I sort of wish I was starting all over again, you know. But then in another way, I say, no, I couldn't go through it all again, you know. I'm happy with what I got. You're never happy, you know what I mean? But you're happy in a way that you actually got your hands on the World Championship trophy, you know, because it's such a, it's hard to get your hands on it. So many great players. But yeah, you'd love to be, you know, young enough to be able to, you know, not have too many sort of distractions, or that you'd be able to just start again and be an 18-year-old and just go through it for a few seasons and see where it take you, you know.
And what's the transition been like, I suppose, going from being one of the newer players on the circuit to being
the oldest? One of the oldest players, like. Yeah, it's not nice when you're called one of the oldest. Like, well, at least Jimmy White is still playing, so he'll always be the oldest. I think I'm the... Joe Swale is next by a month, and then it's me. So as long as those two guys are still around, I'm happy, you know. But yeah, I mean, I'm one of the older statesmen of the game. But it's good to see so many young faces coming through and so many great players. And there's a lot of great players coming from China and now different parts of the world. Snooker is becoming more popular because of, like, Eurosport. It's broadcast in, you know, to hundreds of millions around the world, like mainly across... you know, the old sort of Eastern Bloc countries, which has become very, very popular in, and of course now in China. So it's great. The game has grown exponentially, and it's a good time to be a professional, and it's great to see. But I still enjoy it. I still I don't like the travelling so much. I mean, you know, travelling and it doesn't sort of thrill me like it used to. I mean, you used to get a great buzz at packing your cakes and going off to China or Hong Kong or Thailand or Australia, wherever it might be. It doesn't excite me as much, but I still love the competition. I love being on the tour and being with the lads and, you know, trying to, you know, pitch our wits against the best. That part sort of gives you the buzz, but the travelling and, no, it doesn't, not anymore, you know.
And is it important for the game to have these kind of characters like Ronnie O'Sullivan?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ronnie is like... he's our, like, talisman, you know. I mean, he's done wonders for the game. And I used to, you know, practice with him, because we used to play in the same club, you know. And people always ask me who's the best. Well, when I used to practice with Ronnie, like, I used to beat him 10-2, 10-1, 10-3 every day. I'm not bragging, but he was only 12 at the time, so... but it still counts in my book. But now he's one of the best... well, he's not one of the best. He's probably the best player that's ever played the game. He has to win 7 World Championships, I think, to really say he was better than Stephen Hendry, because Stephen Hendry got 7. But I don't think there's any doubt that he is a genius, because he can play right-handed, left-handed. He's going to make it over 1,000 century breaks in his career pretty soon. You know, 14 maximums I think he's made in tournaments. His stats are just unbelievable. And he's such a talent, he could do it so fast. And his 5:20, like 1:47, was the greatest break that was ever made. There'd be nothing like that ever again. So we're deeply indebted to him, you know, because he's brought so, like Higgins, for snooker back in the 70s and 80s, he brought a lot of people into the game. Jimmy White sort of took over that mantle through the 90s. But since the 90s, O'Sullivan has been not only one of the best snooker players that ever played, but one of the best British sportsman that has ever been, you know. And, like, believe it or not, he's never been once recommended for a Sports Personality of the Year. Not even go into the hat with, like, 10 others. He's never been once even been on the panel for people to vote for Sports Personality of the Year. And he's been at the top of the game for, like, 25 years. And he's won so much. And he's like, one of the best sportsmen, I think, that has, Britain has ever produced.
Absolutely, yeah. And you were talking there about getting, like, maximum breaks and stuff. Mm. Like, what's the feeling like when you get a 147?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm remembered more for missing the 147 for the black, for the beautiful car in the conference centre in Wembley, the final of the Benson Hedges Masters back in 2000. People will always say to me, I remember where I was when you won the World Championship. Do you remember you missed that black for the car? Of course I bloody remember. I still have nightmares about it. But I didn't like the colour of the car, so that was my excuse. But yeah, I mean, I did make one in a professional tournament And I think I got 500 quid for it, whereas the car was worth about 100,000. So there was a little bit of a difference. but that's another one that got away. there's a few of them.
And you're working in radio now with Radio Reggie Corrigan. Yeah. Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I love it. I've been down, Dublin's Talking Sport now and Sunshine for the last 5-6 years. And Reggie Corrigan and I, we have a great fun. We just go in and we talk, do the paper. It's just like talk sport. We have a, talk rugby, soccer. We very rarely talk about snooker, although we've had a few snooker guests in. But we have a great fun doing it, and it's a great medium at the radio. And when the red light goes on and you're live, and people are listening to you, it's a great buzz, and we have a great laugh doing it. And it's not. It's not like walk around. We go in there and we want to go in and really have good fun and talk about topical issues and sport, whatever they may be, and enjoy it. And I love every minute of it. I miss it when I'm away. I love coming home and being home for a Saturday and being able to go in and do it. But when I'm away, I'm always missing and tuning in on the app to see how he's getting on without me,
Magic. Thanks very much for joining us on the Sports Chronicle again. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Cheers.